The Insurance and Banking Subcommittee will come to order. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair DeSegley.
Here.
Vice Chair Haig.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Wilhite is excused. Representatives Barnaby.
Here.
Beltran.
Here.
Brown.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Hardy.
Here.
Coaster.
Here.
Rayner.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Carlos Smith.
Here.
David Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Toledo.
Here.
Zika.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Before we begin, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, as a reminder for our members and presenters, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you are speaking and off when you are finished. Before we get to the presentation, members, I'd like to take an opportunity to quickly and briefly go around the committee room here, give you an opportunity to introduce yourselves, let us know where you're from, the area you represent. I am Chair Nick DeSegley. I represent District 66, which is in West Central Pinellas County. It is paradise, so it's an honor to represent the folks in District 66. So with that, I will recognize Representative Fabricio.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tom Fabricio. I come here from District 103, which is in Southwest Broward and Northwest Miami-Dade. It's truly an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Representative Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Snyder. I'm from District 82, which is Southern Martin County, North Palm Beach. And it's an honor to be here. Look forward to working with everyone on this committee. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Whip Beltran, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm Mike Beltran. I live in South and represent Southeast Hillsborough County, which is also a paradise, but it's a little bit more affordable than the chairman's district. But great to be here and great to be representing District 57. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair DeSegley. My name is Ardian Zika. I represent District 37 in Central Pasco, and I'm honored to serve on this great committee.
Thank you, Chairman. Tracy Costa, representing House District 64, which is Hillsborough and Pinellas County. I look forward to working with all of you.
Thank you, Chairman. Jackie Toledo, and representing District 60 in Tampa, and so excited about this committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Representative Carlos Guillermo-Smith, I represent House District 49. That's East Orlando, East Orange County.
Good afternoon. My name is Michelle Rayner. I represent House District 70. I was born and raised in Pinellas, so I can attest that it is paradise. But I have a little bit of Pinellas County, Manatee County, Sarasota, and a very, very small part of Hillsborough County. I'm very happy to be on this committee. Thank you, Chair.
Hi, I'm Representative Omari Hardy. I represent District 88 in Palm Beach County. My district goes from South County to North County. That's Delray Beach, Boynton Beach, Lantana, Lake Worth, West Palm Beach, Mangonia Park, Lake Park, and Riviera Beach. Happy to be here. Thank you.
I feel like my introduction is going to be so anticlimactic. After that, I am State Representative Fentress Driscoll from Florida House District 63, which covers much of North Hillsborough County, so parts of Tampa and Lutz. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I am State Representative Camilla Brown, hailing from the northern part of the city of beautiful Orlando. I represent House District 45, which encompasses West Orange County. It includes the areas of Ocoee, Winter Garden, the Apopka area, Zellwood, Pine Hills, Orla Vista, and Lockhart. Happy to be here.
Good afternoon. It's actually a pleasure to be here in person, unlike 2 weeks ago. So it's really a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman, and be on this committee. My name is Will Robinson. I represent House District 71, which is the western half of Manatee County and coastal Sarasota County.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Webster Barnaby. I represent House District 27, which is southern Volusia County. It's a great honor to be here.
Good afternoon, Representative Elizabeth Fetterhoff. I represent District 26, which is a large portion of Volusia County. I serve with Representative Barnaby, and I'm happy to be here serving on this committee for a second year. So thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Representative David Smith. I represent the good citizens of East Seminole County. If you're not familiar with Seminole County, it's northeast of Orlando. Happy to be here.
My name is Brett Haig, and I represent District 33, which is Sumter County, a portion of Lake County, and a portion of Marion County.
All right. Thank you, members. I appreciate that. We're going to get to our program this afternoon. We will first hear about current financial regulatory issues impacting Florida businesses from the Commissioner of the Office of Financial Regulation, Russell G. Weigel, if I pronounce that correctly, I hope. Commissioner Weigel, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman DeSegley. My name is Russ Weigel. I'm the Commissioner. Thank you for giving us a chance to speak to this committee. It's an honor and a pleasure, and I hope this is the beginning of a... can I touch this? Hope it's the beginning of a future partnership that we can continue in discussions with and try to address some of the issues that we feel are important to making Florida a better state. Today I'm going to address the issues. They're in our PowerPoint, but these are from the perspective of our three primary substantive regulatory divisions, and also from our investigative perspective. My roadmap for today is this. I'm going to focus on the need for a capital finance ecosystem for small businesses in Florida, keeping our banks competitive, fixing the effects of a court opinion that destabilizes our longstanding interpretation of our money transmission statute, and I'll mention a couple of areas that OFR thinks can be deregulated that we currently regulate. So, advance this. As I mentioned, we're organized in three divisions. We have the Division of Financial Institutions, Consumer Finance, and Securities. And in basically, we are regulating banks, credit unions, mortgage loan originators, securities industry participants like investment advisors and securities brokers, consumer finance companies, those would include like check cashers, payday lenders, foreign currency exchangers, money transmitters, and collection agents. We have enforcement ability or capability in nearly all of the areas that we license. And we also have a division that is empowered to conduct criminal investigations. That's our Bureau of Financial Investigations. Our Office of General Counsel, which we're in the process of currently organizing, is going to be responsible for conducting our civil and administrative litigation component to our enforcement objectives. Statewide, we have five offices, and we are a cabinet agency, meaning we report to the governor, the attorney general, the CFO, and the commissioner of agriculture. We have about 354 employees statewide and a $41 million budget. And all told, we are licensing approximately 462,000 individuals and entities. On our basic mission, is to ensure consumer and investor protection, growth of the economy, and banking safety. And all of our initiatives that we're going to discuss today involve these areas. The first and probably the most complex part of my talk will be talking about our securities divisions initiative to stimulate an ecosystem for the growth of capital financing for small companies in Florida. The basic problem that I see in Florida is that we are great at creating new companies. We've been ranked top three in the last couple of years nationally in our ability to form new companies. The problem is, that we don't have a capital market present in the state that enables those companies to get expansion capital. So nationally, we rank in the bottom 10 in terms of being able to finance our small companies. Now, that creates a number of problems. I mean, part of the problem is Florida's become the third biggest state. The recent three biggest, California, New York, and Texas, are, as we all know, you know, sources of capital funding. They have ecosystems in place. We don't. We're now number three. If we're creating companies that don't get financed, they don't create jobs. It's that simple. You know, we're putting a lot of money into education, and we're educating our young kids, and when they graduate college, you know, one of the likely places that they could go would be, you know, to work for startup companies, because that's, you know, that's an echelon of the business community that would be there for them. And so it's without the ability to get that capital locally, the incentive is for our companies to get it out of state. And it's also an incentive for our students that graduate to go look for jobs out of state. I perceive that we have some degree of a brain drain because of that, but there's no question that the capital sources that that are available, particularly in Silicon Valley, Austin, Texas, New York City, those sources would prefer that the companies that they're funding go out there and relocate. And that is a problem for Florida. I would like this state to be self-sufficient. You know, that's the bottom line. Now, we have tried in the past through legislation. We have a system that involves regulating the offer of security sales to companies through registration with OFR. And we also have a crowdfunding statute that was enacted in 2015. The crowdfunding statute ultimately has never been utilized. We've never had, you can see it from the slide on the bottom line, straight zeros for the number of crowdfunding issuers that have gone through a capital raise in Florida. And part of the reason is the requirements that we put in place for them to be eligible to do an offering, to seek investors. And basically, our program was modeled after the Jobs Act of 2012, which is what the SEC regulates. And it's great for nationwide offerings, but their program requires that the crowdfunder, the person who wants to do crowdfunding, associate with an online portal that's also separately licensed. We modeled our statute to do the same thing, and the problem we have is we've only had one ever apply in Florida, and that is what we call up there on the chart the intermediary. The intermediary is basically a limited function broker-dealer that is in charge of handling all contact with prospective investors. They're basically doing an online like solicitation of prospective investors. That's what the portal does. And that's what the Jobs Act was meant to do, was use technology to enable companies to reach out to the investing public through social media, through other electronic means. And there's no reason that couldn't happen in Florida, and Florida companies are using the national model as well, but the costs to get into that program are high, and they're very high to do a state-only type of crowdfunding, which is our crowdfunding statute. But we can adjust it, or at least I hope we can adjust it, so we can adjust the crowdfunding statute to try to lower the barriers for companies to be able to source capital here. We have a couple of ideas in that regard. One of them is to, we have to incentivize first somebody to file a registration for a portal application, to become an intermediary here. And so we need to lower the barriers and restrictions that portals have to go through to get our get a license issued. But we also don't necessarily need to limit our companies to that want to raise crowdsourced capital in-state. We don't need to necessarily limit them to have to associate with a third party to do it, because that's inherently more expensive. And I always pointed to Georgia, because Georgia has a crowdfunding statute, but they don't have a requirement that we have to follow, or that they have to that the issuer has to associate with a portal. They just allow the issuer to do it themselves. And I think that if the companies have the capability to do it themselves, why can't they? There's also issues about, you know, why isn't the broker-dealer community helping out? Why aren't they incentivized to come and become the licensed portal? Why aren't they doing that? And frankly, you know, the reality is we have a cap on the amount of capital that can be raised in an offering. It's currently set at $1 million. The SEC just raised their cap to $5 million, and Georgia's has been $5 million for a number of years. But brokers work on a percentage basis. It's basically working on commission. And so when they are going to put about the same amount of due diligence work into investigating whether they want to work with a particular client, and they're capped in their fees by our, you know, million-dollar cap, and they have the opportunity to do offerings that are uncapped under other registration regimes, why wouldn't they do that? Because their risks are substantial in handling small company financing. That's why the broker-dealer community really hasn't entered the space. The people that have entered the space are entrepreneurs that see the benefit of online sourcing, basically. Move ahead. So I mentioned we have a registrations regime here in Florida. We have a system where companies can file what's called a registration statement. It's basically an application with a prospectus, and they file it with OFR, and OFR decides whether the company has the merit to go forward with their capital raise. And our statute, it's called merit review, the system we have, and the statute precludes small companies from participating, basically, because one of the disqualifiers in our statute is that if you're insolvent, you're ineligible. Well, every startup company is implicitly or inherently insolvent. So that just takes off the board our entire startup community as being eligible for this kind of a program. The other is the revenue. We have an eligibility requirement that says you have to be 3 years in revenue before you're eligible. Well, once again, you know, the startup community is not able to participate in that because almost every startup has to go through some period of growth before they go into revenue. And many companies, by the time they get into revenue, they can get bank financing. So they don't go the securities route or you know, it's just a statute that's not working for anybody really, because you can see this is our actual data. Number of applications for a merit review offering, you know, between 2015 and 2020, ranging from 4 to 9 applications. About half of them were either withdrawn or denied. Only one of them was from a Florida company. So we've tried to, you know, figure out how we can best address this, how best to spark an ecosystem. And, you know, a couple of ideas. I mean, some are like implicitly obvious, I think, from my previous comments. I mean, if we can lower the barriers to crowdfunding, if we can lower the barriers to doing registered securities offerings in the state. Hopefully, we can then lower the costs that a prospective company would incur if they try to go forward with doing a solicitation in our state. And I'm encouraged. I think that, you know, entrepreneurs that are in the portal business, you know, would be excited to do business in Florida if we could make it more enticing for them. If we did things like raise the amount of capital that can be raised, if we allow them to do other things in the state, not just require them to do only crowdfunding offerings, you know, why can't they do other offerings? If they can do a crowdfunding offering, why not other ones? That kind of flexibility, you know, to offered to entrepreneurs, I think, is going to be an exciting conversation. Another aspect of this is incentivizing the networking. This, I think, is really the ecosystem, you know, being started, is incentivizing the people that know the investors who have capital and would be willing to invest in small companies locally, and they know the companies that are in need of it. Oftentimes, those people are called finders. Presently, they're illegal in Florida. They are, however, legal in both California and Texas, you know, our two biggest capital source states. Finders are basically just similar to the portal, not necessarily operating online, but more face-to-face, more relationship-based. And but like portals, they're basically, the idea is that they're limited function brokers. In other words, they can't handle the capital in any way, shape, or form. They're just going to be compensated for introductions. That would be the idea. And the benefit of doing that, you know, from an enforcement standpoint, is that if we create a licensing regime for them, I mean, they're going to go through OFR's regular background checks and registration process would be the idea. And and then the people that are in that business already that are not licensed, you know, would automatically become, I think, you know, enforcement targets for us, but I think they would also, you know, be a group that would be inherently shamed out of the business, and I think that would be appropriate. So that's the essence of the ecosystem idea. One of the comments that I think is sort of implicit in a conversation like this is, well, what about, you know, aren't we going to let more fraud into Florida if we do something like this? And my answer is, well, we have fraud, and we have plenty of tools to address it already, and we don't need additional tools. But OFR, on the one hand, we're doing all we can to approach this in sort of a double barrel approach. I mean, we're both using our existing capabilities under our statutes to police the state, and we are trying to refashion the ways we're going about it, because we're trying to address other things, and I'll get into that in a few minutes. But you know, one of the ideas with our financial investigations unit is simply, you know, we're trying to address more of the electronic fraud, more cryptocurrency fraud. We're also trying to, you know, address the protection of our vulnerable investors in the state, and I'll touch on that in a second. But I don't think we need more statutory authority for this. I just think, you know, ultimately, when I tell you how many people we actually have that are in this space and how much work they're doing, it's really just boiling down to a money issue.
Commissioner, excuse me for one moment, if I may. I just want to remind you have about 6 minutes.
Okay.
I know you've got some slides to go through here. We want to make sure that the members have an opportunity to ask you questions. I just ask you to please keep that in mind.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
I will, absolutely. Went through the hardest part right there. So The next issue I wanted to bring to your attention is one of, I think, statewide importance. This is for our Division of Consumer Finance. We have, I mentioned, we regulate money transmission in the state. First of all, OFR has had a longstanding viewpoint on how and who should be licensed and regulated in this space. And basically, it boils down to we license third-party intermediaries. So we license the people that are couriering cash. We license the people that are transmitting cash. And those would be your Brinks trucks or your Western Unions. So third-party intermediaries. If somebody comes to one of them and wants it to have cash transmitted or delivered to a third party, they hand it to the intermediary. Those are the people we license. Well, the third DCA, 2 years ago in 2019, they came out with an opinion that it was a cryptocurrency case, and because of the nature of cryptocurrency, which is more peer-to-peer based, we think they've greatly expanded our jurisdiction to include basically every transaction, theoretically, that involves cash. And we currently are stymied because we have 11 declaratory actions, in the pipeline that businesses want to start new money transmission businesses in Florida. But they have this court opinion on the one hand, and then they have OFR and the statute on the other, and they're asking for our clarification, and we can't give it to them. What we're asking for, and we want to discuss, is a definitional fix of what the intermediary idea means. And that would solve that. I think I'll just touch for 1 second on some of the deregulatory things I mentioned, but we have a federally mandated national mortgage loan system that all mortgage loan originators have to apply through every state. But Florida has a statute that also says that you need a high school education requirement fulfilled. Well, that just procedurally bounces every application for a Florida licensee. They have to go through us to prove that. The problem ultimately is not everybody can establish that they have a high school diploma, even if they did have one. Some schools don't exist. Some people are from other countries where those records are difficult to get. It's a manual paper process that frustrates the electronic NMLS system that is otherwise very efficient. We think that that's an area that doesn't actually result in any real benefit. It's a good idea to say people ought to have a high school education. That's great. They're already required. Everybody nationally is required to go through certification training, in the specific space of mortgage loan origination anyway. So we think that the value add there is limited. And commercial collection agencies, we've never been given enforcement authority over. We register them, but we don't do anything with them. We can't take complaints. If we get complaints, we can't do anything with them. And so we just throw that out there as something to discuss, because it seems to be regulation for regulation's sake, and we don't think it's the best thing for us. Lastly, I want to talk about our financial institutions. And this is about keeping our banks competitive. Our banks face heavy competition from out-of-state depository institutions. They face competition from federally licensed institutions. And they also face competition from non-depository financial institutions. And there are a couple things that we think that we can do. We want to modernize our code to make it more competitive for our Florida chartered banks to be able to compete in this environment. But a couple of aspects of that we wanted address specifically, and that is our charter application process for commercial banks is one that's subject to the Sunshine Act. That's anti-competitive for many of the banks because they don't have those requirements out of state. And here they do. And banks don't charter here if they can avoid it, just because we have that sunshine applicability, we're suggesting that the state cloak those applications while they're under review with OFR, because the reality is bank supervisory personnel, the bank management that's filing those applications, they have strict requirements of employment history, background. They're already in the industry, probably already employed at a bank before they would file such a charter. And it has a chilling effect on those folks who would be interested in filing in Florida, because the filing of the application may be newsworthy, and their names get out in the public, and then their employer sees it, and we think that's a bad thing. So the idea of cloaking the application while it's pending with us is the idea, and uncloaking it when it's approved. And at that point, the new crew at the bank would be known to the public anyway, and we don't think there's harm by keeping it cloaked in the interim. And the last thing I'll touch on is, modernizing our application process to get away from the brick and mortar idea that is embedded in our current statutes, where a bank has to define a geographic area and propose a business plan for that area. Why can't they be electronically based banks? Why can't they be enabled to focus on a target market of their choosing? It could be in the state, it may be out of state, it could be anywhere. Why can't they do that? We would like to modernize our statutes. I think that would make Florida more competitive in this space. I'm probably out of time, so I'll skip the rest of the financial investigations discussion and open it up to comments, questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate your indulgence on the time. Members, we are in the question portion here. Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You started the presentation by saying Florida ranks in the bottom 10 in the growth of companies. These are small businesses.
Yes.
And you proposed some solutions, but what I didn't see in here was any solutions specifically from government as opposed to from financial institutions to make some of that capital available. I think you know that this, for example, the Emergency Bridge Loan Program was enacted earlier this year. It offered $50 million in loans. We saw the tremendous need out there, as demonstrated. There were 38,000 businesses who applied. We only had enough funds to issue 1,000 loans. Do you think that state government needs to play a stronger role in offering direct relief and this type of assistance to help those small businesses grow, especially right now during the coronavirus economic crisis that we're having?
Thank you for your question, Representative Smith. Did I get that right? Did I say your name right? Thanks. I don't have an opinion specifically about that. What the approach, during that same time period, OFR actually tried to reach out to other institutions in Florida, other arms of the government, and that seemed to have focuses on financing businesses in the state. And we looked at the opportunity to partner with them possibly in this area, and our effort was not successful. And you're right. I mean, the money ran out, in that particular program immediately, and it just raised the specter of what should we do as a state, and that's a discussion I would be willing to entertain with anybody and everybody. OFR doesn't have an opinion on it, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. We just took the approach from there let's see if we can enable the private sector to solve the problem.
Representative Zika, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair DeSigley, and thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation, and I thank you for your leadership on addressing certain issues that can place Florida in competitive position to compete with other 50 states and at a global level. And obviously, based on your presentation, page 8, We do rank top three on formation, and on the growth piece, we're struggling. And I appreciate your concerns around the capital markets, because generally speaking, capital flows to mid-size and large corporate sectors of the company creation, and on the lower end, the startup component, they don't. So in your opinion, do you believe that this would be a critical piece of legislation for the state to address, so we can place Florida on a competitive landscape to address these issues?
Yes, thank you.
Commissioner, you are recognized. Thank you.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry, Chairman. Thank you, Rep. Ziga. That's the reason I applied for the job, because that's what I saw the lack of it in the marketplace. This has been my career almost from day one. You know, being in this securities industry as an attorney, and an attorney in Florida. So you know, I'm well familiar with the lack of capital opportunity, you might say, for our smaller businesses. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think it's a very important thing, and I think it inherently is a job growth issue as well. You know, it's not just financing business, but it's also keeping jobs and keeping jobs in the state and people that we've already invested in and educating them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think, as I mentioned before, I think Florida can and should be self-sufficient. This is a piece of it, I believe.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Representative Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner Weigel, for your work within OFR. Just a couple of questions going back to that Espinoza case. I understand that was decided 2 years ago, and that there are currently 11 petitions for declaratory statements that are pending. Is there a current obligation now through both current law and statutes and case law that you apply current case law and statute to those petitions within 90 days?
Yes, that I believe is the mandate for adjudication on them. I believe, Representative, that I didn't get the authority to speak. I'm sorry.
You're fine, Commissioner.
All right. Thanks. I believe in each one of those cases, Representative, that the applicant or petitioner had agreed. I mean, we've contacted all of them and explained the situation that the court case implies, and I believe all of them that are currently in the pipeline, the 11 I mentioned, have agreed to waive their timelines. So that that is the current status, and I think I don't know the number if there have been withdrawals, but I believe there have been some that have just decided this is not the state.
Thank you. You have time for one more question, Representative Hardy. You are recognized for a question.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. If you can tell me, you say that Espinoza kind of destabilized the law around how you regulate currency transmission and things like that. I guess, why do you perceive it to be a problem? I guess, why are you turning down or asking us to make a definitional clarification that would, I guess, not allow you to license these folks?
You are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative, for your question. If I understand it correctly, well, we our view has been the only party that needs to be recognized or licensed in a money transmission transaction is one who's going to be a third party, not the recipient. You know, somebody it's an intermediary receiving cash, and then having the obligation to deliver it to the recipient, and the implications of the court case are vast. So, as I mentioned, one of the essences of the cryptocurrency aspect in that case is that it implies that peer-to-peer transactions would need to be regulated. And that almost is, it's impossible. You know, I mean, can you imagine if, I mean, would I need a license to buy your mask from you, handing you cash? You know, that would be peer-to-peer. And I mean, that's kind of the implication of the court case, I think. And we wanted to put it squarely back into you know, redefining, you know, what the intermediary is and it's for. That would be one way to fix it. I think that would be the simplest. I mean, it can be a discussion about a much broader topic. I mean, it is a cryptocurrency case, and Florida doesn't have any regulation of that space either, or I shouldn't say either, it doesn't have any regulation of that space currently, per se. You know, the solving that immediate situation for those businesses that want to do business in the state and they're worried about what their licensing obligations are, a definitional fix should solve that. I hope I answered your question.
Commissioner, thank you for your presentation. Members, again, if there's any follow-ups with the commissioner, I encourage you to reach out to his office. So thank you very much, Commissioner. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. Appreciate it.
We will now hear from three presenters on the second topic, insurance company consumer impacts and trends in property and motor vehicle insurance claims. These presentations will complement the insurance issues that we covered here in our last meeting and in the last Commerce Committee meeting. So Meredith Brock Stanfield, the Director of Legislative and Cabinet Affairs with the Department of Financial Services, will make some introductory remarks and provide some context for the next two presentations. Ms. Stanfield, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief given our current time constraints, but on behalf of CFO Jimmy Patronis, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to focus on consumers. As you guys work to legislate insurance issues, you can't go wrong by putting the consumer first. As the CFO frequently says, every single session he has worked to fight for consumers and will continue to do so. And at the Department of Financial Services, consumers are at the core of our mission, and the CFO has two very powerful tools at his disposal, the Division of Consumer Services and the Insurance Consumer Advocate. The Division of Consumer Services does the yeoman's work daily to directly serve consumers. Our Insurance Consumer Helpline is a lifeline to Floridians looking for assistance. Please take down that number when Greg talks about it in a moment. There's a reason it's on all of our business cards. They assist thousands of consumers every year with insurance-related issues, advocate directly on their behalf, and provide outreach. Tasha's role, we were so excited in August of 2019, the CFO appointed from within to appoint Tasha Carter as our insurance consumer advocate. She works independently from the department, but closely with the CFO, more broadly with insurance consumers and stakeholders, particularly to find consumer-focused solutions on policy matters and advocates on their behalf for rate and form filings with OIR. Much like the department, we have a great working relationship with the Office of Insurance Regulation, freely share and receive data, and the ICA fulfills an important role of ensuring everyday Floridians have a voice in insurance policy setting process. A lot of what you will hear today will be the bulk of what our legislative package is this upcoming session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up will be Greg Thomas, the Director of the Division Consumer Services and the Division of Insurance Agent and Agency Services for the Department of Financial Services. Mr. Thomas, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you indicated, I am Greg Thomas, the Director of Consumer Services for CFO Jimmy Patronis and the Department of Financial Services. Our division is a statutory division, is created in law, and our function is to educate, assist, and advocate on behalf of consumers. That function is laid out in the law, and it lays out several obligations that we have to perform. Those include receiving inquiries and complaints from consumers, preparing and disseminating information that can assist them, providing direct assistance and advocacy for them, and notifying regulators if there are potential violations that we uncover during the coursework of handling these complaints and questions. The law also gives the department a tool to encourage response from regulated entities of both the Office of Insurance Regulation and the Department of Financial Services in that there's a 20-day statutory timeline for them to respond to our inquiries, or we can actually levy fines against them for failing to do so. The way that we accomplish these tasks are we operate a consumer helpline. We have service requests that we handle, and you'll hear me interchange the word service request and complaint because they're much the same. We operate what we call our alternative dispute resolution program, and what that looks like, we'll get into the details of, are a variety of different programs to help to resolve disputes between parties. And then finally, I'm going to talk about our civil remedy notice program, which notifies insurers that someone is intending to sue them. It's a pre-suit notice program that is also statutory. In addition to those areas, there's a couple of other things in the statute. I'm not going to spend a bunch of time on those. We handle a bunch of correspondence and requests that come in via the website, and in addition to operating a consumer helpline. And then we also maintain a website that's full of information, guides, videos, and different things that consumers can use to educate themselves on both insurance and financial issues. As I talk through this, I'm going to focus primarily on automobile and homeowners insurance. I'll touch on some broad topics, but I'm going to try to narrow it per conversations with your staff that we're going to try to focus in on automobile and homeowners insurance issues since those seem to be hot topics this year. The consumer services team is on the front lines every day, as was mentioned by Meredith. And what they do is take literally thousands of calls each and every day and answer those questions that consumers have. And those things can vary from one end of the spectrum to the other. Our staff handles calls on everything from a Medicare supplement to a washing machine warranty to a commercial general liability policy. So it is really all over the board. Our workloads are going to be fluctuating from year to year based on what's going on in the marketplace and stuff, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But today I'm going to focus primarily on the granular level. I'm going to give you a lot of data, so I apologize in advance. Our ICA, Tasha Carter, is going to get into sort of the bigger picture policy stuff that comes out of that data that we're generating. I want to talk a little bit about storms as well as we walk through this, because hurricanes can obviously have a tremendous impact on our workload. It ebbs and flows greatly depending on when storms hit, where they hit, the severity of them, and a variety of other factors. What I mean by that is two storms can be comparable in size but have a different impact. In that one mainly is a water event and another is maybe a wind event. Water is really largely a federal issue, whereas wind is more of a state issue. And as a result, when we get a hurricane with a lot of water, like Sally as an example, we don't see much activity, whereas we see one like Michael with a lot of wind activity, we see a whole lot more activity. Calendar year 2020 is one that I think a lot of us would like to forget for a lot of reasons, but interestingly enough, it was actually one of the more predictable years for consumer services. We had a fairly routine year in that Sally was our significant hurricane, and it was mainly a water event. Generally speaking, our call volume, and this slide will hit some of the points. The department, and this is the empowering statute reference there that creates the division, 624.307, and it lays out those functions that I talked about earlier. So you see the points there. I'll go ahead and jump ahead to our consumer helpline. So generally speaking, in a normal year, we're going to handle 20 to 25,000 calls a month. That's a normal month for us. Last year, calendar year 2020, 248,744. The portion of those that were related to automobile and homeowners insurance was 13,391, 5.4%, which I suspect surprises a few folks, as you would think that's probably one of our bigger areas, but in fact, it actually isn't from a call volume standpoint. You see some other areas listed there. We have our fraud line. We answer 1,081 calls. We take fraud requests and pass those directly over to our law enforcement division. We took rehab and liquidation calls. What those are insolvent insurers that a consumer is having questions or problems with. And then we deal with other lines of insurance, life insurance, annuities, health insurance, washing machine warranties, as I said, and a variety of other things. All of those other things totaled 58,884. Altogether, if you look at those statistics, we handled about 88,000 insurance-related calls. Add to that the other call volume that we take. We also answered the department's unclaimed property line for people that are seeking unclaimed property to the tune of 51,000 plus calls. And we also answer the licensing line for people who are interested in becoming licensed as insurance agents or adjusters. And there are almost 109,000 of those calls. As you might expect, as I touched on a little bit, when we have a storm, it can displace some of those other areas. So the unclaimed property calls might not get through because there's so many people trying to call for the other. But our volumes do go up, too, with those types of events. So I'm going to talk a little bit about service requests or complaints here as well. Our service request. Our service requests are much smaller than our call volume. Not every call results in a complaint. Calls are someone seeking information, and many times we're able to provide that information, help them get on their way, help them shop for insurance, help them to know what the next steps are for a claim, and they move on and start and handle the rest of it by themselves. It's when they reach that point where they're having difficulty and they need assistance, they come to us and say, I need your help. Or we perceive, based on what we're being told, that there's a problem there, then we would, in those cases, open a consumer complaint for those individuals. Last year, 19,010 of those. Of that, 7,319, or 38.5%, were auto and home related. So if you'll recall back, we only had 5.5% of our calls as auto and home, but we have 38.5% of our complaints being auto and home-related insurance issues. Let me talk real briefly about what we do with those complaints. As these come in, we communicate. I told you earlier that we have the ability to require an insurer or an agent or an adjuster to respond to us. We will communicate with them and ask questions of them regarding the information that's been presented to us by the consumer. So we reach out to them, we ask them to answer some questions based on what we've been told. We take that information and may go back to them again. Ultimately, our goal is to try to get the consumer to a situation where they have been properly addressed and handled by the insurer or their agent or adjuster. About a little over a third of the time, 36% of the time, that's the case. We're able to get them some help. In other words, get a claim paid that had not yet been paid. It was delayed. Get some additional money paid on a claim that had not yet been paid. Get a policy reinstated. Get a premium refund made. Those are the kinds of things that we'll see in that handling of those. The other two-thirds of the time, what our answer to the consumer looks like is a response explaining why they are in the situation they're in from a contractual standpoint, statutory standpoint, whatever the case may be. So they may be seeking coverage for something that's not covered under their policy, as an example, and we will explain to them that, yes, the insurer is right and that they've denied the coverage because there is none under their policy. It may not seem like handling or helping a third of people is all that important, but that number is 6,000 to 7,000 Floridians each year that see a positive impact from our efforts. that positive impact can look like different things. It can look like that policy reinstatement, but it can also result in money, and I mentioned that briefly. So I want to talk quickly about that. Last year, we assisted consumers in recovering $23.8 million that they had not yet been able to recover until our involvement. That sounds like a pretty big number given the situation, but if you just look back 1 year prior, that number was $52.5 million. Why the big drop-off or what happened that prior year? Hurricane Michael was at the end of 2018. Claim disputes start bubbling up at that point, and that is why you see those numbers so high. Hurricanes drive those numbers because we get involved in assisting with those settlements. I'm actually going to talk about hurricanes real briefly. These are a couple of slides that were shared last year, and they speak specifically to the two hurricanes, and you'll see some differences here between these. Michael generated 2,671 phone calls at the time that we put this together. It's generated a few more since then, but the volume has dropped off pretty dramatically for both of these storms, as you might expect. It's been some time. And it generated 1,791 complaints. If you look at the call data, and that's what you see up here from Michael, 42% of the calls were general information about how do I file a claim, what do I need to do, who do I contact, what's the process. And then another 41% were delays, prolonged delays, can't get a follow-up, can't get a response from the company. And then those last two categories, the 9 and 7%, they sort of meld together and they can bleed into the others. The policy coverage question is, does my policy cover this kind of thing? So it may ultimately be a claim question or not. And then the claim denial, cancellation, and policy non-renewal issues tend to be situations where the claim has occurred, there is a loss, and they file a claim and they find out they don't have coverage, and then they're seeking help trying to figure out why they don't have coverage or to get coverage retroactively reinstated so that they have coverage and that type of thing. If you look at the complaints from that storm, 59% of those complaints dealt with claim handling delays. 39% were other things like denials, underpayments, et cetera. So let's move over to Irma, and you can see a little bit different picture. So Hurricane Irma, 51% of the questions were about the process, and then 28% were with delays, so you didn't have quite as many delay calls in that one. And then look at the complaint numbers. 29% were claim handling delays versus, if we go back, 59% for Michael. Dramatic difference in those, in the claim handling delays that escalated greatly. 69% were for denials, underpayments, et cetera. So why? Well, there's a lot of questions around that, and I think ICA Carter is going to talk about some of her findings with regard to that. The interesting thing is that Hurricane Irma happened in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, which hit Texas and Louisiana. And there was a cry that we were going to have a mass shortage of adjusters, claims were going to be delayed greatly, but it didn't materialize if you look at Irma. But then we had Michael 13 months later, and we saw the delays occur at that time. Okay, I'm going to move on over and talk about another of our programs real quick and get out of the details on those. Alternative dispute resolution. This is a group of statutory programs that we conduct, and these programs are designed when a person reaches impasse. They cannot resolve a dispute with their insurer. We may have already handled a complaint. Sometimes we have, sometimes we haven't. They call us, they seek mediation or neutral evaluation. Homeowners mediation, all of these are statutory programs. Homeowners mediation is the lion's share of our program, which is not unexpected given that we're still in the wake of two hurricanes and there are a lot of those hurricane-related claims that are going through mediation at this time. Sinkhole neutral evaluation is a program just for sinkholes for homeowners claims, so it is a homeowners-related program, but the difference is with the mediation, you have a Supreme Court-certified mediator conducting the process, whereas with sinkhole neutral evaluation, you have an engineer or a geologist who also has the ability to go out and inspect property, et cetera. Then we have our auto mediation program, and our other programs. You'll notice there was 9,295 homeowners mediation programs and 46 auto mediation programs. And that probably prompts the question of why so few if you have a lot of complaints and calls in auto insurance. The reason is that the laws are different for these two programs. For homeowners mediation, neutral evaluation, those situations, the insurer pays 100% of the cost. For automobile mediation, the cost is borne equally between the parties. As a result of that, the auto program is virtually non-existent, honestly. Very few people utilize it. The last thing I want to share with you, moving on, is our civil remedy program. I touched on that at the beginning. Civil remedy is a pre-suit notice. What it is it's a statutory requirement that someone who wishes to sue an insurer has to give them 60 days to cure the problem, 60 days notice, before they actually initiate the lawsuit. And the law says that the department is the intermediary here, if you will. We receive these notices. And prior to July 1 of 2020, that was our role. The party filing the notice would send that notice to us and would also send it to the insurer that they intended to sue, potentially. In the last legislative session, Senate Bill 1606 changed that, and it requires the department not only to be the recipient of them from the filer, but also to distribute them to the insurer, that is the party that it is being targeted in the situation. So we now pass those through our process. The law spells that out and basically doesn't give us a role other than to be that intermediary. So we don't have a significant role there, but we can see data from it if we want to look at it. So looking at the data and what you would see here from, this is calendar year 2020 as well, we had homeowners insurance related civil remedy notice of 27,369. And then we had automobile civil remedy notices of 38,309. So let's think back just a minute to the other numbers that I gave you. So we had 3,714 homeowners insurance complaints. We had 9,351 mediation and sinkhole neutral evaluations. So that's a total a little over 12,000, but a bunch of those complaints were about premium and things that wouldn't go to litigation through this program. There are actually 11,500-ish that were claim-related that would ultimately go to litigation. So with 11,500 complaints, mediations, everything, we have 27,369 potential lawsuits filed for homeowners insurance. The even more interesting piece is the automobile insurance piece. Looking at the automobile insurance, we had 3,605 auto complaints and 46 mediation requests. But of the automobile complaints, there were, again, a bunch of them were not claim-related. It was my policy got canceled or that kind of thing. 2,455 is the number there. 2,455 total complaints and mediation requests, 38,309 potential lawsuits related to those or to other things that never came through us. What this tells you, there are some other things besides, we had a few more, 4,000 or 5,000 more, but roughly 95% of all civil remedy notices are automobile and homeowners insurance related. Mr. Chair, that's my presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Members, I want to remind you we have about 27 minutes left in this meeting. We will be ending this meeting on time. So with that, if there are any questions for the members, we're going to limit it to about two questions. Are there any questions for Mr. Thomas? Sir, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate that. Next up, we have Tasha Carter from the Florida's Insurance Consumer Advocate. Ms. Carter, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tasha Carter, and I am Florida's Insurance Consumer Advocate. And thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share with you some of the issues that are facing the industry and how consumers are being impacted. I take just a few moments to provide a brief overview of my role. The Office of the Insurance Consumer Advocate was created by the legislature in 1992, and the office is overseen by the Insurance Consumer Advocate, who was appointed by the Chief Financial Officer. I was appointed by Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis in 2019, and while appointed by the CFO, I work independently from the Department of Financial Services. I actively engage with and serve Floridians by working with stakeholders and consumers in an effort to try to find consumer-focused solutions to insurance matters. Some of my key focus areas include balancing Florida's insurance market to ensure that the market is valuable, competitive, accessible, and affordable for consumers. I also identify trends and marketplace practices by reviewing market reports, consumer complaints, and also engaging with stakeholders. And then I also focus on increasing consumer awareness and education to ensure that consumers are informed and they can make solid, good insurance decisions. And I also provide them with information on how to be their own best advocate. Additionally, I also assist consumers one-on-one with specific insurance-related issues that they may have as well. And then I engage legislatively and administratively to represent the interest of Florida's insurance consumers in venues where insurance decisions are made. So in summary, I serve as the official representative and voice for Florida's insurance consumers. And now I would like to talk a little bit about some of the issues that are impacting the industry. And I'm going to talk about these factors from two different perspectives: marketplace behaviors and claims handling practices that are harmful to consumers. And then I'm going to talk about industry factors that are impacting the insurance industry as a whole, which is also result in harmful consequences for consumers as well. The relationship between insurance companies and consumers is one of trust. Consumers trust that their insurance company will help them repair and rebuild in the aftermath of a catastrophe, while insurance companies trust that the information that's reported and provided by consumers is accurate and honest. Unfortunately, when that relationship is compromised, it can result in damaging consequences. And what I would like to share is throughout this presentation, you will hear references to solicited claims. You will hear me reference inflated invoices, insurance schemes, all of these types of factors that result in litigation and increased costs and expenses for the industry and ultimately higher rates for the consumer. However, I want to definitely make sure that I point out that the overwhelming majority of claims are legitimate, valid claims, and they should be paid promptly. However, as I engage with and I assist insurance consumers daily, I've noticed several recurring trends. Consumer complaints typically center around unsatisfactory settlement offers, claim denials, claim handling delays, and lack of communication from their insurance company. I always try to make it a point to obtain direct feedback from consumers because I think that feedback is so valuable and helpful. For example, in 2019, after Hurricane Michael, I hosted a consumer town hall meeting in Panama City to receive feedback from consumers as it relates to their Hurricane Michael insurance claims experience. 100% of the attendees indicated that they experienced unnecessary claim delays. 75% of the attendees experienced a lack of communication from their insurance company. 66% of the attendees received unsatisfactory settlement offers. And after experiencing these challenges, 83% of the attendees felt it necessary to hire an attorney or a public adjuster to assist them as they tried to navigate the claims process. And they hired these professionals an average of 6 months after filing the claim. Lack of communication between policyholders and companies results in confusion, breakdown in communication, and it can lead to litigation. These trends indicate that policyholders hire a public adjuster or an attorney to improve communication, level the playing field, and to ensure that they are being treated fairly. Last November, I also surveyed more than 7,000 policyholders whose claims were represented by an attorney to obtain some feedback on their claim and attorney experience. And regrettably, some of the same trends and marketplace practices that were occurring after Hurricane Michael are still occurring. 78% of the policyholders hired an attorney due to a claim denial, claim delay, or unsatisfactory settlement offer. 40% of policyholders hired an attorney within 6 months of filing the claim. These are the issues consumers consistently contact me about daily, and these experiences lead consumers to hire an attorney. Consumers are harmed when claims are unfairly denied, underpaid, or take too long to be paid, and some are forced into prolonged and expensive legal battles just to receive legitimate and rightful insurance benefits. Consumers purchase insurance for protection, and they pay a premium with the expectation that insurance companies will protect them when the time comes. So these type of marketplace behaviors and claim handling practices can lead to litigation, which affects not only the individual policyholder, but the industry and all other consumers as well. Mr. Thomas and I work with insurance companies and stakeholders constantly to assist in resolving and addressing these types of marketplace practices. I will now transition to the factors that are impacting the insurance industry, and these factors combined with the claim handling practices I just described are harmful to both consumers and the industry as a whole. Okay. Several factors that are impacting the insurance market and adversely impacting consumers, and one of those is insurance fraud. Insurance fraud costs more than $40 billion annually, which costs the average family between $400 and $700 a year in increased premiums. In a recent survey by HomeAdvisor, 36% of homeowners indicated that fraud was their biggest concern when they were hiring a contractor. Typically, in the aftermath of a hurricane, dishonest contractors canvass neighborhoods, oftentimes within a day or two, and they entice homeowners into signing an AOB. After collecting insurance benefits, some of these contractors disappear without ever doing the work. And in cases where repairs are made, the contractors are doing sub-work and using substandard materials. Additionally, some of the contractors may be unlicensed. We are now experiencing a trend where this type of canvassing and solicitation is no longer limited to the aftermath of a hurricane. We're experiencing this happening in communities across the state on a regular basis. A solicited claim typically results from an assertion of damage that, instead of being identified by the homeowner, is identified by a third party, typically a contractor. Most solicitations occur by contractors canvassing neighborhoods, offering incentives or financial inducements, such as a $500 gift card, for a free inspection. Oftentimes, these inspections result in a filed claim that may include inflated invoices, AOBs, directions to pay, and may ultimately end up in litigation. There's a current investigation involving a senior community in Lee County that involves 15 carriers, one contractor, and one public adjuster, and one attorney. At least 11 claims have been filed citing Hurricane Irma damage. Residents are promised a new roof with no out-of-pocket expenses if they sign a contract with the public adjuster, the contractor, and the attorney, and then they are coached on what to say to the public adjuster when they come out and visit the home. So these types of tactics and schemes are resulting in carriers paying higher negotiated settlements or paying additional costs to litigate claims. Claims from multiple hurricanes have also impacted the market. Hurricane Irma generated more than 1 million claims and an estimated $20 billion in insured losses. Hurricane Michael generated 160,000 claims and an estimated $9 billion in insured losses. Due to the 3-year time frame to submit hurricane claims, additional Hurricane Michael claims may be filed, which will continue to increase the total number of claims and claim-related expenses. It is very challenging for an insurance company to effectively and adequately adjust a claim when it is reported years later. For example, additional damage could have been caused by other perils in the interim. Data appears to indicate that late filed claims may be generated as a result of solicitations, and the end of the claim filing timeframe also appears to be a driver in the uptick of claims filed. For example, more than 3,600 Hurricane Irma claims were filed with Citizens last year prior to the 3-year Hurricane Irma timeframe. 55% of those claims were filed in the 4 months preceding the deadline for an average of nearly 500 new Irma claims each month. The uncertainty of future claims and future litigation associated with those claims increases projected risk for the insurance companies, which ultimately causes them to raise rates. Last year, reinsurance rates, which is insurance that insurance companies purchase, increased on average by 57% due to the severity and frequency of overall claims, higher catastrophe claims due to multiple hurricanes, and claims for water damage from leaks that were not hurricane-related. Litigation is another factor. Litigation has increased by 210% over the past 7 years. The number of civil remedy notices, which are notices that must be filed with the Department of Financial Services at least 60 days before initiating litigation against an insurance company, those notices have increased by over 500% in the past 5 years. And additionally, some industry data reveals a limited claim cost at a minimum 4 times that of a non-litigated claim. Through my policyholder survey, I received feedback directly from policyholders who were represented by an attorney. What is of interest is that 10% of those policyholders hired an attorney before even filing the claim, before they even had an opportunity to become frustrated or displeased with the handling of their claim. 5% of the policyholders were not aware that an attorney had been hired to represent their claim, and in those instances, the policyholders indicated that 57% of the time, those attorneys were hired by a public adjuster or a loss consultant, and 43% reported that the attorney was hired by a contractor. What is also revealing as a result of that survey is that those policyholders who hired an attorney due to a claim denial, 86% of the claims were subsequently settled. So they were initially denied, and 86% of those claims were subsequently settled. This may be an indication of claims being unfairly denied and subsequently paid after the policyholder hires an attorney, or an example of insurance companies settling claims that are not covered in an attempt to avoid future litigation and additional costs and expenses. As a result of these factors, who is most negatively impacted? Consumers. Consumers can't find insurance companies that are willing to write them. They can't afford the coverage due to increased rates. And in the current market, consumers are paying more for less. Florida has the third highest property insurance premiums in the country, with an average annual premium of more than $3,600 a year. Consumers are paying higher premiums for less protection and fewer options. And this significantly impacts seniors who are living on a fixed income and typically living in older homes. In addition to increasing rates, a number of insurance companies are not offering coverage in specific areas around the state. And they're not willing to underwrite homes that are more than 15 years old. Higher premiums and limited coverage result in fewer and fewer options and are forcing homeowners to seek policies from Citizens, which was created to be the insurance company of last resort. For many homeowners, Citizens has become the only option, and as a result, Citizens is currently growing by an average of roughly 3,000 policies a week. Fewer carriers in the marketplace means less competition, which also means higher rates for consumers. Another impact that is not readily recognized is the effect on the real estate market. Homeowners who have a mortgage are required to have property insurance. A recent study indicated that nearly 80% of borrowers are paying their insurance premium through an escrow account. Increased insurance rates will result in higher escrow charges and higher mortgage payments. Additionally, buying or selling a home may become challenging if it is difficult to purchase insurance or if the insurance premium makes the mortgage payments unaffordable. So the rising rates have also caused some homeowners with no mortgage to forego coverage altogether. They have chosen to self-insure to avoid the high premiums. What is concerning is that they would be responsible for repair or rebuilding should their homes be damaged or destroyed. All of these factors result in reduced availability, reduced protection, and reduced affordability. If you would indulge me for a few more minutes, I would like to share some specific consumer examples that will help to further illustrate the impact these factors are having on consumers and on the market as a whole. As it relates to contractor solicitations, during a 4-week time frame last spring, an insurance company received 32 claims from one Southwest Florida community. The claims included 14 claims for Hurricane Irma damage and 18 water damage claims for kitchen and bathroom leaks. All of the claims were reported by the same law firm and the same public adjuster. The homeowners were solicited, and many of them indicated they were unaware that they were hiring an attorney. The homeowners filed 22 AOBs through one water mitigation company and 21 AOBs through a mold testing company. 13 homes filed 2 claims, 9 homes filed 4 AOBs each. The claims, along with the AOBs, have the potential of more than 70 individual lawsuits. Invoices submitted by the law firm, the water mitigation company, and the mold testing company totaled more than $816,000. So these schemes go beyond just inflating insurance claims. Such claims clog up the litigation system, create additional costs for insurance companies that must be factored into their underwriting and their claims expenses, and ultimately result in higher premiums for consumers. Another example of this type of activity is the increase in roofing contractor solicitations in the villages. This is an issue that our esteemed vice chair and I have discussed. Over the past year, the villages have been inundated with door-to-door solicitations from roofing contractors who are approaching homeowners, claiming their homes have roof damage, and then persuading the homeowners to sign an AOB. Most often, the homeowners do not fully understand the AOB and the impact when it is abused. Re-roofing permits in Sumter County grew nearly 420% over the past 2 years. The county issued 3,500 roofing permits through 8 months of last year, compared to 1,200 for 2019 and 680 in 2018. Another example of the misuse of a repair agreement relates to an elderly Bay County couple who filed a Hurricane Michael claim as a result of damage and minor mold to their home. The couple signed a direction to pay agreement with a contractor, and they were told they would need to move out of their home while it was being repaired. They moved out of their home. The contractor came in and completely gutted their home, removing personal property, drywall, and other appliances. 1 year later, the restoration company has not completed the work, and the home is still uninhabitable. When the couple attempted to rescind the agreement, the restoration company sent the couple an invoice for $99,000, and when the couple refused to pay the invoice, the company filed a $100,000 lien against the company's home in Bay County Circuit Court.
Ms. Carter?
Yes.
Excuse me 1 second. Representative Hague moves that we extend the meeting for 15 minutes. Show that motion adopted without objection. That was for you, Representative Smith. So, Ms. Carter, if you wouldn't mind kind of coming for a soft landing, and then we're going to get to some questions because we do have one more presenter after you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one additional consumer story that I would like to share. Due to her dissatisfaction with her current homeowner's insurance company, a Pinellas County senior sought new coverage, and her agent was only able to find one company that offered her a quote with an annual premium of nearly $3,000. The quote required a $500 initial payment and a monthly payment of $229 for the remaining 10 months. Her only income is from Social Security, and she cannot afford to pay the premium. These are her words as she described her situation. I am perplexed at how insurance coverage seems to work. People pay premiums for their coverage. Then when you have a claim, the insurance companies are hesitant to pay for the repairs for one reason or another, of which they seem to have many. This is our money from premium payments, which are substantially high, that goes towards paying for the repairs. I cannot get new coverage, and I am forced to stay with my current company. My policy comes up for renewal in June, and if there is a substantial increase that I am unable to afford, I will be forced to sell my home and move in with my children, which I do not want to do. Can you offer any advice? These stories are eye-opening, and they are just the tip of the iceberg. Consumers are facing difficult challenges, and I am speaking with consumers weekly about these and similar experiences. And so in respect of our limited time, I'll end there. I do have some specific legislative proposals that will definitely help to protect consumers, reduce litigation, reduce rates, and improve the overall consumer experience. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Carter, appreciate that. Members, again, we're limited time here, so we're going to, if you can limit your questions as much as possible, I'd appreciate that. Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Carter, for your presentation. So it seems like there's a myriad of things going on, but what I'm hearing is that when we're thinking about litigation, it's not necessarily because you talked a lot about fraud, you talked a lot about insurance fraud, contractor solicitation fraud. So is it fair to say that it's not necessarily always insurance companies wanting to take consumers for a ride, but they also have to compensate for the amount of fraud that's happening, especially, you know, when it's around catastrophes and those types of things?
Mm-hmm. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Representative Rainer, for your question. Yes, I think that's a great way to kind of categorize the information and the data that we're seeing throughout the industry. I think there are definitely circumstances where policyholders are bringing litigation against insurance companies because they do believe that they have not been treated fairly, and so they want to level the playing field and want to make sure that they're receiving their proper benefits. On the other hand, I think data does point to the amount of contractor solicitation fraud and other types of fraudulent schemes that are absolutely impacting the insurance industry, forcing insurance companies to potentially settle claims that otherwise would not be settled or would not be covered, and also resulting in increased litigation as a result of lawsuits that these third-party vendors are bringing forward as well.
Representative Hardy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The OIR receives these form filings, and they review them. Are you able to review those alongside the OIR? Are you able to opine on what you see as it comes in? Do you think that would be a good thing for your office to be able to do?
Mr. Chair.
You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hardy, for your question. Yes, so I work very closely with the Office of Insurance Regulation. I do play an active role in reviewing the insurance rate filings that are submitted, and I do have an opportunity to participate in those public hearings and question the company representatives. At this time, I do not have a specific role in reviewing the form filings that are submitted, but that is definitely something that I have shared with the Office of Insurance Regulation, and we are currently actively working on trying to establish a mechanism and an avenue for me to be able to become a part of that process as well.
May I?
You have a follow-up?
Yes.
Representative Hardy, you recognized for follow-up?
Thank you. Following up on what Representative Rainer asked you, If you could talk a little bit about the quantity or the proportion of some of this litigation that is basically being put on the insurer's plate here. Some of it is happening before a consumer even makes a claim, and some of it is happening after a claim is being denied. Can you tell us, you know, about what share is what there?
Sure.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your follow-up question, Representative Hardy. So what we're seeing throughout the industry and in receiving feedback from consumers and insurance companies and stakeholders in the industry is that typically when a claim is filed and the policyholder has already hired an attorney at the time that claim is filed, typically, you know, it's a result of some type of solicitation effort, whether it's a solicitation by a contractor or a public adjuster. Usually one of those entities has referred that policyholder to the attorney. And that's some of the feedback that we noticed in the survey that I conducted last November, where 10% of those respondents indicated that the claim was filed, they hired an attorney before the claim was actually filed. On the other hand, what we're seeing is when attorneys become very frustrated and displeased as they attempt to navigate the claims process, at that time, it appears as if consumers are then hiring an attorney to assist them through that claims process and to ensure that, you know, they're being treated fairly by the insurance company.
Representative Fabrizio, you are recognized for one final question for Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Carter, there was AOB litigation passed in 2019. What effect have you seen that have with consumers?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for your question. So we've seen some initial data that indicates that there has been a slight decline in litigation associated with AOBs as a result of that AOB reform. But on the other hand, what we've also seen is an increase in the use of other types of repair agreements and hybrid agreements that don't fall under the statutory authority of the AOB law. And so, for example, a direction to pay agreement, you know, really, for all intents and purposes, works very similar as an AOB, and it essentially directs the insurance company to send insurance payments directly to the specific vendor or contractor. And what is happening is individuals are using these similar repair agreements that still include some of the harmful language that the AOB law prohibited, and these agreements are still being misused and are, you know, resulting in harmful consequences for the consumer.
Your follow-up?
Follow-up. You're recognized.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Carter, would you then be requesting a broadening of the scope of the AOB statute as it currently stands?
Recognized.
Thank you. Yes, as a matter of fact, excellent question. That's one of my legislative proposals, is to expand the current AOB law to include these other types of direction to pay agreements and other hybrid agreements, so that the consumers who are entering into these types of contracts will have the same protections that are afforded to them by an AOB.
Thank you.
Ms. Carter, thank you so very much for this presentation. I think I can't stress how important it is to make sure that the consumers are at the top of our priority list with whatever public policy comes through this committee. You do a great job. We appreciate the hard work you do. And thank you very much for your time and your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our final presentation. Members, we have 14 minutes, so if I'm going to have to interrupt people, I apologize ahead of time. Our next presentation will be by the Commissioner of the Office of Insurance Regulation, David Altmaier. Commissioner, you are recognized to begin your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. I am David Altmaier. I am Florida's Insurance Commissioner. I see a lot of familiar faces. It's good to see those of you that I've had the chance to work with in the past, and I'm looking forward to working with those of you that I haven't had the chance to work with. We're going to do a presentation this afternoon that follows up very nicely with some of the presentations that you heard from Greg and from Tasha. We're going to talk about the OIR's market regulation function. Before I get to that, this is certainly not the only function that we do. If we had a little bit more time, I'd spend a little bit more time talking about these, but I'm certainly happy to come by at any time and spend extra time with you individually or with the committee as a whole to talk about many of the important things that we do in order to protect Florida's insurance consumers. One of the most important things that we do is our market conduct function that you see up there. Our market conduct function is the business unit within the Office of Insurance Regulation that assesses the compliance of insurance carriers with the insurance code as it relates to the way they treat their consumers. So this is different than what I've talked about in the past with respect to our financial regulation or with our form and rate regulation. This business unit deals directly with how our consumers being treated and our insurance carriers treating them the way that we as a regulatory authority and as a state would expect them to do so. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things that we utilize as we go about this. But one of the most important things that we utilize is what Greg talked about just a moment ago, which is direct consumer complaints. So what we've got on this slide, and this is why this is kind of a nice follow-up to Greg's presentation, you heard a lot of statistics from Greg, and you might have wondered, once we see that level of consumer complaints, what happens? How do we ensure that those consumer complaints are not related to insurance carriers that are out there just wildly misbehaving in the wild, wild west of Florida's insurance market? And our market conduct business unit is the answer to that question. On a regular basis, we meet with Greg and his team about the consumer complaint data that they're seeing. I'd love to highlight the fact that that's relatively seamless because Greg and his business unit are in the same business unit as us, but that's been a little bit less relevant over the past year. But we still have maintained really close communication with Greg's team. So the primary difference between what Greg's team does and what our team does is as Greg gets a consumer complaint, he works through that complaint from the standpoint of how do we resolve this for this consumer that has complained to us. Our role in that is to look at it and determine how many other consumers like this are out there experiencing the same situation with this company? And do we have a one-off situation where a claims adjuster or somebody at the insurance carrier was just having a bad day? Or do we have a broader issue of some systemic risk that the carrier is just has processes or procedures that are out of compliance with our expectations? So we take the complaint data that Greg just shared with you all, and we run that through a series of processes, and we might initiate a certain number of activities that we'll talk about in a few minutes, and we will make sure that those consumer complaints are not the result of carriers who have bad practices, bad policies, and bad procedures in place. So that's the interaction between DFS and the Office of Insurance Regulation when it comes to consumer complaints and with our market conduct business unit. So what do we do if we do happen to notice that some of those consumer complaints are not necessarily just one-off situations of bad behavior? We've got a few different options that you see here on the screen, going from a relatively informal process to a process that's much more severe for the insurance company. So on the left-hand side of that screen, you see that the first step is an inquiry. So what will generally happen as we look at these consumer complaints, we'll look at it through a couple of different lenses. The first one is, number one, does it look like this consumer is complaining because the insurance company broke the law or because they violated the insurance code in any way? If that's the case, we might launch an inquiry to get some more information from the carrier about why that might have happened. The other situation that we might look at is not necessarily a violation of Florida law or the administrative code, but more along the lines of, is one person complaining that this company delayed their claim, or do we have 20 people complaining that this company delayed their claim? If it's the latter, we might launch an inquiry into that company to find out what exactly is happening to cause so many consumers complain about your claims handling practices. From there, if we find evidence that there is some kind of process that's out of whack at the insurance company, we can go into a more formal investigation, which is the next step. That's really where we start to take enforcement action against insurance carriers. We might find out that they are violating some aspect of Florida law, or they are out of compliance with some aspect of the Florida Administrative Code, or they do have higher than we would expect delays in claim handling and things of that nature. So we would go through the process of formalizing an investigation. An investigation can result in any number of administrative actions, anything from fines to the insurance carriers, all the way up to suspending the insurance company from operating in the state of Florida. So after investigations, you get to examinations. And the primary difference between investigations and examinations is that investigations typically look at how an insurance company treated a subset of their insurance carrier. So if, for example, if Greg got 20 complaints, an investigation might be, what did you do wrong on those 20 insurance consumers? The examination takes it a step further and asks, are there more than these 20 consumers that might have been mistreated that we just don't know about because they haven't picked up the phone and called us yet? So we can transition an investigation into an examination to determine, is this activity more widespread at the insurance company than we might think or that we might otherwise know through the complaint data?
Commissioner, this is your two-minute warning before we open up for questions.
Roger, appreciate that. That is essentially perfect timing because that is essentially our market conduct function and how we try to close the loop between the information we get from Greg and how we actually go to the insurance companies and talk with them about that. There are a variety of other sources that we have in addition to the information that we get from DFS and Greg's group, including Tasha Carter and the Insurance Consumer Advocate. We get regular information from the insurance carriers themselves. We call that the Market Conduct Annual Statement. We're able to utilize that information to determine if we see any red flags at insurance carriers that might need further follow-up. And we have the ability to call examinations at our discretion. So for example, we currently have 10 examinations open, two recently closed with respect to Hurricane Michael. These are examinations that carriers did not trigger any complaint threshold or any kind of red flag. We just wanted to go and make sure that given the volume of claims from Hurricane Michael, that carriers were treating their consumers correctly. And so we've got a number of examinations going on there. such an important function at the Office of Insurance Regulation to ensure that consumers are being taken care of by their carrier. Would love to answer questions that you have about it this afternoon, and if you have additional follow-ups after this afternoon, happy to pay each of you a visit as you're able to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner? Or you got lucky. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hardy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what has to happen in order for Florida's insurance consumer advocate to be a little more involved in the review of form filings?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question, Rep. We are working very closely with the consumer advocate to ensure that she does have access to what we're working on, that she's involved with that. I think we were having biweekly and monthly calls with the insurance consumer advocate and her staff between her, our office, our form and rate team to make sure that she can see the relevant form filings and the relevant rate filings. And so we're looking forward to continuing that and looking forward to expanding the ways that she's able to interact with our staff at the office.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, if there are some specific things that would need to happen in order to allow that with the form filings, what exactly would that be?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I don't think there's any statutory changes that need to happen. One of the challenges with the form filings is that the office has a pretty significant time crunch with respect to approving those. When a carrier makes a filing with us, we've got 30 days to review and approve that. So we're trying to squeeze a lot of review into a short window of time. A lot of them are routine form filings. Some of the ones that are a little bit more impactful to consumers, we're able to pull out ahead of time and chat with a lot of stakeholders about those ahead of time. So I think it's mainly just a process issue for us to work through with the insurance consumer advocate and make sure we're checking that box.
Representative Rayner, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just have a quick question. When you talked about the difference between violation of law or admin law, is it fair to say that when you are looking at the complaints and inquiries that come in, it's not necessarily that the insurance companies are willfully violating the law, but it's really more so consumers may not understand the process?
You are recognized.
Yes, Representative, that's correct. There's a mix there. Unfortunately, sometimes we do find carriers that either inadvertently didn't follow the law, the admin code. A lot of the times, it's just a consumer that's just upset, and that's a lot of the reason for the complaints a lot of the times. So we work through that as best we can with Greg and with Tasha and with their teams to try to resolve that as best as we can. So there's a mix there.
Commissioner, thank you so very much. I appreciate your time. And again, members, there's so much important information that we have in our purview here in this committee. And I appreciate you allowing me to interrupt and keep this meeting moving along in the extra 15 minutes. So if you have any questions for the presenters, I highly encourage you to follow up with them at your convenience. So thank you all for presenting to this committee. I appreciate it. If there's no further business, that concludes our agenda for today's meeting. Representative Zika moves, we rise, and without objection, the meeting is adjourned.